afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Elodie Cederstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. My co-host, Alfred Adisk, and James Corbett of the Corbett Report will be here after the first segment of today's program. So let's get started right away with the market report for Thursday, October 13th, 2016. Well, we had a little bit of positive news today for gold. And again, it was much higher early morning, came back. They tried to hit it, but we're still looking at 320 in the New York spot price after market, $1,259. You have silver up 3 pennies. At 17.58. Platinum was down 6 at 939. Palladium was down 8 at 643. And that really kind of makes sense with platinum and palladium, and I think this is what's has been some in part affecting gold and silver is, you know, China has come out with some very bad economic numbers, you know, so you could see a little bit of flattening in platinum and palladium, and we did see today with a little bit of strength in gold and silver. The USDX today is trading a little bit lower, 0.40. It's another reason we see, you know, saw a little bit of a stronger gold. 97.56 crude oil rebounded a little bit, keeping it above 50, up 30 at 50.48 for crude oil. And the stocks fell this morning. I mean, they were down triple digits early in the morning, but they've recovered, of course. And much of it was the weak data that was coming out of China, a little bit on the rising oil prices. And, of course, they're always, no matter what, going to blame the possibility of a Federal Reserve rate hike. You know, if it's whether they raise or whether they don't, that all remains to be seen. But yet they can use that for anytime they need to use or have an excuse or a reason why the markets did one thing or another. Hey, it's the possibility of a Federal Reserve rate hike. Anyway, we did have the Dow Jones. It dropped more than 150 points. It came back. Goldman Sachs basically contributed to most of the losses in the Dow. It did break through the 18,000 mark briefly, and that was the lowest level since July 7th. At the low today, it was down 184 points. Let's see where it closed at. A modest 45. Down 45 points, 18,098. The NASDAQ was down 25 at 52.13. And the S&P was down 6 at 21.32. The 10-year yield, 1.74, euro 1.11, so that popped same amount as what the dollar was down. The euro was up. European markets, Germany was down over 1%, Hong Kong over almost 2%. The others were just modestly lower. And if we look at what emotion is driving the markets, you wouldn't notice, you wouldn't think it was fear, at 37, considering still having a pretty good turnaround, though, almost have a 200-point drop in the day, and reversed it to down 45 on the Dow. And again, most people are in the NASDAQ, and that was down 25 points at 52.13. So not a bad day there, but, you know, it's just weird news. It's election. It's the only thing that's in focus. If it wasn't about the election, it was China. As I mentioned, weak data coming out of China. China's exports fell the most in 7 months. You know, transatlantic revolt against central bankers. Hey, we, you know, I mean, it's just very weird news. I think one of the interesting things that's really, in my view, this report, gold would have been up $20 minimum. But Iran deploys warships off the Yemen coast. They sent two warships to the Gulf of Aden on Thursday, today, and to have their military presence in the waters, where the U.S. military launched cruise missile strikes on areas that are controlled by Iran-backed Houthi forces. So the U.S. military strikes were in response to failed missile attacks this week on a U.S. Navy destroyer. There was two of them, I believe. And so I found that interesting. So now you're going to have the Iranian ships that are going to patrol the Gulf south of Yemen, which is one of the world's most important shipping routes. So does this mean anything? you know, again, it's just one of these things. You know, when was the last time, you know, we talked about Yemen? You know, this is the first time this week in a very long time. So it's always something like this. And again, Iran sending two warships after we have, you know, did some of our own, launched our cruise missile strikes. So again, interesting, something to watch. All eyes are focused on Russia and what's happening in Syria. And here's something, that looks like it's, beginning to awaken. So again, gold should have been up a minimum of $20-$25 based on that alone. A couple of the main banks are going to report tomorrow, Friday, Wells Fargo, JP Morgan, Citigroup. You know, Wells Fargo is going to get most of the attention, based on, John Stump, the CEO. He is taking an early retirement and he's still going to walk away with about $130 million. Not a bad retirement. I think he was there like 30 years. Not that that justifies $130 million. And, you know, he was crying because he was going to forfeit some stock awards worth about $41 million. And his salary for 2016 and also a bonus. Because his bonus was directly tied to some of those accounts that was opened up without the customer's knowledge. Fraud, theft, whatever you want to call it. So yeah, he's being punished a little bit. You know, that's probably the amount that Wells Fargo is going to be fined. So they're figuring they'll take it out of his pay now. So he's heading out of the way. So of course, all eyes are on this. And you know, it's just more of the same. You know, just a bunch of distractions because this is exactly what it is. So, you know, the Fed is still expecting to raise rates in December. And you know what's funny? This is exactly what they said a year ago. The Fed was, remember, a year ago, the Fed was expected to raise rates four times in 2016. So what has changed since last year to warrant a rate increase in November or December, especially this after this election that we're having? So yeah, it's not going to happen. Let's see. On Friday next week, you have Bank of America, Goldman, and Morgan Stanley. They're all, they'll be releasing their latest results, I believe, next week. And, you know, we all know this. We all know how the media is controlled. It's owned by six companies. You have 232 media executives control 277 million TV viewers. You know, the revenue for this, and this goes back to 2010, was $276 billion. So you could probably increase that by, you know, probably $500 billion. So it's probably $500 billion. 80% of USA radio stations have the same playlist. These five, six companies control 70% of cable programming, control 66% of movie revenue. You know, so again, it's difficult to find really what's going on in the world today. But that's what we're here for. That's why you tune in to Financial Survival. And I was just told recently, it's like, you know what, Melody? You're the only financial radio program anywhere. You can't get financial news information anywhere. And I think this is true. You get various analysts, newsletter writers that talk about the economy and so forth, but on the radio and having a regular program dedicated to finances and dedicated to what will happen to your funds if you don't get them protected with gold and silver. And this, it's just not a long infomercial here, just here at this program. It is helping you to understand why it is so important. You know, I thought this was interesting. The Republican, and not new news, it's not surprising news, the Republican National Committee insists that it's doing everything in its power to elect Donald Trump. But Trump continues to get clobbered on the TV airwaves by the Democratic rival Hillary. And the RNC has been absent. And a political analysis of campaign finance records reveals that the committee has not spent anything on commercials boosting Trump since he emerged as the party's likely nominee. I mean, that's in a stark departure from recent elections. They have spent tens of millions of dollars on these so-called independent expenditures. And mainly they were TV ads. You know, they did other things, direct mail, phone banks, and so forth. But mainly it was television. Because, as I mentioned before, you had, what, 277 million TV viewers. Well, you're going to get a pretty, you know, pretty good response for your dollars. But the RNC, says, no, we don't. Which I find that very hard to believe. And certainly Donald Trump has a lot to fight because everyone is fighting against him. And he is doing extremely well for doing what he's doing. So, again, it's just another... just another area where the RNC says, "Hey, no, we're here. We're trying to help you out in other areas." But I would certainly think that the television commercials would be a very important. But again, they're moving away from independent spending, and that is their excuse, and that's what they're sticking to. Tomorrow you have October 14th, and we talked about these money market mutual funds that the rules are changing. The government changed the rules based on 2008. And these are the money market mutual funds. They're open-ended mutual funds. They invest in short-term debt securities, U.S. Treasury bills, commercial paper. And what they do, they pool money from investors to purchase short-term investments. And for those of you who don't know out there that are listening, as of May of 2010, there are more than 600 money market funds in the United States. Now, they've been working on these changes since 2010. Now, I would think that these money market accounts, these funds, would have already made any changes. I don't think they would wait until tomorrow to start making all these changes, even if it's been predicted that you were going to have $300 million or $1 billion being pulled from these accounts. And maybe they would. Maybe they would keep their money in there until the changes actually occurred, and then maybe afterward they're going to start doing the adjustments. You know, so we could see this happen. We have seen the numbers go down a little bit since 2010, since they decided to regulate this area. Money market funds are widely regarded as being as safe as bank deposits, but yet they provide a higher yield. But that's not necessarily true. It's not accurate. They are not guaranteed. But because we saw what government did, they did get bailed out. Since they were created back, I think, in the 70s, they've always had this illusion, you know, the analysts, and there was always this idea that they were safe and guaranteed. The $3 trillion U.S. money market fund industry, of course, was targeted for regulatory reforms, and of course that is to make it more transparent and less risky, if you believe that. This is what goes into effect, and this is what some of those high-profile newsletter writers are claiming will crash the markets. Yeah, I'm not so sure. And again, as I mentioned, most of these accounts aren't going to wait till the last minute, but even if they did, you know, I don't think they're going to do anything. Government wouldn't allow them to do anything to affect the markets. They would protect the market as much as they could. And again, as I mentioned, they're not guaranteed. The fund managers were allowed to assume that the net asset value, the NAV, the net asset value, was always a dollar, valuing the assets at their amortized cost. So long as the net asset value, the mark to market, didn't fall below 0.995. And there's only twice in their 40-year history that the money market funds, what they call, broken the buck. It was in 1994 and again in September 2008 with Lehman Brothers. Panic ensued and financial markets were largely frozen. The illiquidity caused many money funds to have difficulty selling assets to meet the redemptions, which that week in September 2008 amounted to $310 billion, or about 15% of industry assets. But if you all remember, the U.S. Treasury provided a backstop guarantee in the industry funds until the crisis abated. So this is one that they are changing. Moody's Investment Service estimated that 36 of the top 100 largest U.S. prime money market funds would have broken the buck without financial support from the government, from the taxpayer. So, you know, here comes the government, always ready to help. So these changes make effect. One of the changes is there's going to be a capital buffer, and there are going to be redemption restrictions, which would probably result in a lower return and possibly some investors' angst if required to wait 30 days for a portion of their funds. So if they want to pull their money out, they got to wait 30 days for a portion of their funds. And now it's no longer tied to the dollar; it would be required to float. Okay, so they have a float now. The funds would be required to float their NAV rather than maintain the stable $1. And so, again, government comes in here, and it leaves these money market funds susceptible to loss of principal. So, again, reasons why the idea that $300 billion you could see coming out of these funds. Fidelity Investments, they're the dominant player in money market funds. They have more than $400 billion in assets. Disputes the notion that retail investors are unaware that their principal is at risk. Well, you know, investors really did think that their principal was safe, like a bank deposit, and that wasn't true. And to me, the interesting is the U.S. government money market funds, they're going to be permitted to retain the stable $1 per share. And they could offer this to institutional investors. And what's interesting, as it just always seems, you know, the U.S. government money markets, they're going to be allowed to retain the stable $1 because they always know the taxpayer is there for any bailout money that is needed. So I just wanted to touch on that to give you a little bit better understanding. Is this why we're seeing pressures on the market? I don't think so. Could it have an impact? It could. Is it a knee-jerk reaction? Maybe. Or is it something that's going to be, you know, something that we see over a month's period of time? Possibly. Have we already seen money being pulled out? Maybe. So there's a lot of ifs in that. Remember, folks, we still have the Peace Dollar Special going on, $710 for 20 brilliant uncirculated Peace Dollars. These were minted in the 20, along with a 1/10 ounce American Gold Eagle coin. It includes all your shipping costs for $710. So make sure you give us a call at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Make sure you visit our website at dgscoins.com. Alfred and James Corbett will be with you in just a few short minutes.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Many, many people have experienced the benefits of drinking all-natural Life Change Tea. The unique blend of 8 herbs helps detoxify your body so you can live a healthier life. Numerous testimonies have been given about the benefits of drinking Life Change Tea. So, are you drinking Life Change Tea? Interested? Log on to GetTheTea.com. That's GetTheTea.com. Many are so impressed with our product, they order a year's supply. And why not? When they do, they receive 2 months free. That's a $70 savings. The body is meant to heal itself. Sometimes the body just needs a little help. Get the tea at GetTheTea.com. That's GetTheTea.com. Or call us at 928-308-0408. That's 928-308-0408. This is not an ordinary green tea, and it's not available in stores. This tea helps with digestive problems, acid reflux, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, and as talk show host Jerry Doyle says, it'll make you as regular as a baby bird. Enjoy your life. Get Life Change Tea at GetTheTea.com.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Addisk, and this is Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188. Our guest is James Corbett, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, from the CorbettReport.com. James provides some of the best interviews, commentary, articles, podcasts on the internet on geopolitics in general and economics and almost everything. He isn't capable of speaking about. Tonight we're going to talk a little bit about the prospects of war in this country or in the world. Matter of fact, and let me see if I can find my first. Here's the first one. Here's the first comment. This is from Turo Activist. Headline says, Trump and Putin. Legitimate concerns or anti-Russian propaganda? Trump's connection to Russia or connections to Russia are a key factor in the election, according to the corporate media. However, most coverage of the issue suggests this is less about attacking Trump and more about painting Russia as the enemy. Is there a legitimate concern about Trump's apparent affection? And that might not be the right word, but he seems to like Putin. Is that a problem? Is it much ado about nothing? Is it dangerous? What do you think?
The fact that a presidential candidate's musing that it would be a good thing if we could get along with Russia is being derided as some sort of horrific statement tells you everything you need to know about where the American political scene is right now and where the American political establishment is in terms of their absolute, I mean, just off the charts fear-mongering over Russia and the fact that it has to be apparently assumed and taken as a given in politics that Russia is a mortal enemy, and treating them as anything but that, as even floating the idea that you could get along with them, is apparently somehow off the charts ridiculous. And contrast this to 4 years ago in 2012, you might remember that Romney was on the campaign trail talking about how the greatest threat to America was Russia, and of course was being dutifully laughed at by Democrats for making that a statement. But now it's, I guess, things have completely flipped. Here's the thing that to me is disturbing about this, because clearly I think it's not just an attempt to demonize Trump, it's not just an attempt to demonize Putin, it is an attempt to lump them together and demonize both at the same time. But the disturbing part about this is the extent to which the Democrats and the, I guess, the left generally in the United States is embracing this strategy to the point where, as Glenn Greenwald pointed out in an editorial on The Intercept recently, it becomes dangerous because if and when Hillary gets appointed on Selection Day, what becomes of the political the space for political dissent then? Because it is being painted that the only criticisms and the only critiques and the only information coming out about Hillary is some sort of giant, it's no longer a giant right-wing conspiracy, it's a giant Putin-led conspiracy. So that the idea is that it demonizes anyone with critique or dissent from for Hillary Clinton. So what happens when she inevitably is appointed, crowned the Queen Emperor of the United States by the voting machines? What will happen at that point to the space for critique, even even on the left, it evaporates, or at any rate, it is criminalized or demonized or marginalized. So that's, I mean, it is a dangerous thing to be playing this rhetorical game, because it becomes a political reality when it's repeated often enough.
And that's a very upsetting situation. They keep repeating that, oh my gosh, we have to go to war with Russia. Oh my gosh, we have to go to war with Russia. Oh my gosh. Does it disturb you how easily the mass of people seem to be persuaded? They keep hearing the same lie over and over and over, and they take it for truth. I don't know if you find that disturbing. I find it frightening.
It is disturbing. And this is coming from someone, I'm no fan of the Russian government per se. It's just that I don't think that, certainly don't, I don't think that this constant warmongering rhetoric emanating from the United States and constantly pushing is going to accomplish anything good on the international scale. The only thing it will do is at least maintain the tensions, if not increase them, if not lead us into some sort of actual conflict, which is, I mean, again, in Syria, things are, the pot is boiling once again with all of this Aleppo talk, and now they're seriously talking about the UN Security Council. We need to reform it because Russia is using their veto, and they're an international pariah. Definitely we are back in the kind of rhetoric that we have seen many, many times in the past, reserved for people like Saddam Hussein and Muammar Gaddafi and Assad, and now it's being turned against Putin. We know where this story goes, and that's not in a direction that I think any thinking human being on the planet wants this to go in.
I agree. I agree with you 100%. You know, we have precedent when we talk about Hillary criticizing Putin in a way and demonizing Putin. And you were asking, what comes next? What are they going to do? George W. Bush demonized Saddam Hussein, claiming that he tried to kill his father. And it became a rationale for justifying the invasion of Iraq. Saddam Hussein did something to allegedly try to kill George W. Bush, or George Bush Sr., and George W. said, well, you know, can't let this guy get away with trying to kill my daddy. So America goes to war. Well, it does seem they're running the same scam again, or at least something very much like it. We demonize Putin, we can justify going to war. There's an article here from Ron Paul Institute, published by the Ron Paul Institute, written by David Stockman, and the headline is "Enough Saber Rattling Already." Is that all we're looking at? Are we only looking at saber rattling right now, or is this really getting serious?
It is both. I mean, technically speaking, all it is at the moment is rhetoric and words. But there are things to back that up, that include, I mean, not only what's happening in Syria, what's happening in Ukraine, but also the sort of general, the context of all of this, with the installation of the satellite missile systems and all of these things, which are clearly aimed at Russia and at surrounding Russia and at trying to destabilize the countries that are in its erstwhile orbit sphere of influence. All of this are actions that are aimed at Russia. And can you imagine, I mean, again, I am no fan of Putin, and I don't think he's a great human being, but can you imagine if there was a, shall we say, more hot-headed person in charge of Russia at the moment? I mean, it is incredible the amount that Russia is,
I agree,
kind of putting up with the tensions, the rhetoric, the accusations, the name-calling, and all the military preparations that are going on the NATO side as well. One could imagine if you were a Russian right now, you would be pretty nervous about where this is heading.
I think everyone should be nervous. If we're going to have, I mean, here's Michael Snyder. I'm sure you recognize the name. He has an article. Is Russia preparing for a nuclear war with the United States? And he says the Russians have worked incredibly hard to upgrade and modernize their military in recent years. But in the meanwhile, the U.S. military is being transformed into a radically politically correct social experiment by the Obama administration, and the implication is maybe we're so busy making sure that transgender people have their own washrooms on the aircraft carriers that maybe we can't fight well anymore. But do you think Russia is preparing for a nuclear war? And if so, is this nuclear war going to be confined to Syria? Or does Russia get bombed? Do we get bombed? How far does this extend?
Well, the only context that we have to work with in terms of nuclear strategic thinking is from the Cold War era, where a lot of these, not only the weapon systems, but the strategies for how they would be used were developed and implemented. And there have been changes in the U.S. Nuclear policy since then, to the point where there is now room in the U.S. nuclear strategy for first use tactical nuclear weapons, not strategic nuclear weapons, okay. Not the big boys, not the big bombs, but the tactical ones, the B-61s they're kind of
they only kill a few tens of thousands,
exactly,
rather than a few millions,
more like a Hiroshima than a Tsar bomb kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
That has been worked in, and one can imagine they don't just work those types of things into the nuclear strategy for the country without the intention of actually using them in some manner at some point. The details are going to escape me at the moment, but I do remember some deliberations back in the 50s, I believe during the Eisenhower administration, that were to the effect of, we have to normalize the idea of the use of nuclear weapons in order to put teeth to the mutually assured destruction idea. So, I mean, we could really look at a situation where tactical, so-called tactical nuclear weapons might be deployed, even if for no particular military need, so much as the sort of psychological need to indoctrinate the public that this is not the unthinkable thing.
And also to intimidate. I mean, if you're willing to detonate a nuclear weapon out in the middle of nowhere, it's still going to catch your adversary's attention, and they're going to say, uh-oh, these guys are serious. But it might even precipitate them to react in a way, we're not going to wait. You know, light up the ICBMs and let them go. The whole thing, it is absolutely a kind of insanity. Normalize the use of, it's like Dr. Strangelove.
It really is.
Did you see the movie?
Yes, of course.
Yeah.
You see, this is the problem, because to a certain extent you might say, oh, this is just rhetoric and they're using it to get elected, or they're using it to drum up business for the military-industrial complex or what have you, and I think there is an element to that. But at another level, when you do ramp up the tensions like this, then all it takes is a the wrong person on the wrong day, something going mm-hmm. wrong on the battlefield, mm-hmm. and it becomes a real war. And that is obviously something that humanity does not want at this point.
We've got an article from the Daily Mail in the United Kingdom, and the headline is, World War III will be extremely lethal and fast. U.S. Army bosses reveal what could happen if U.S. took on Russia or China. And say it's a chilling vision of the war, one unlike anything we ever fought. U.S. military bosses have revealed their predictions for a major conflict and say war between nation states at some point in the future is almost guaranteed. Well, okay, at some point in the future, I'll go along with that. But I'm interested, first off, in their comment on nation states, and they say it again. Say artificial intelligence and smart weapons would be at the fore. With modern nation states acting aggressively, the likely enemy, army bosses have revealed. I see nation states twice in this article in the first couple of paragraphs. Are we going to have a war that's designed to push us into the arms of the New World Order and eliminate the nation states?
I think when and if World War III of whatever sort that takes place does take place, it will be ultimately for that effect. It will be about what emerges on the other side, in exactly the same way World War I and World War II were ultimately about that. It wasn't so much, I mean, does the average person on the street today even really know what World War I was about, let alone who the belligerents were or what side they were on or what was gained or lost on what battlefield? The ultimate effect of that was the mechanization of war, and B, the redrawing of the map in the Middle East and elsewhere, but C, also the creation of the League of Nations, and then World War II, and of course the United Nations, and we'll never allow this to happen again. And now it's interesting, isn't it, that right now the United Nations Security Council is in crisis, and this is leading us towards some potential military conflict in Syria between Russia and the U.S., which could lead to a World War III. If it did, one could very well imagine it was the failure of the U.N. Security Council. What we need is a bigger and better and more, you know, a United Nations with teeth, ultimately. And that's, of course, exactly what it has been consciously aimed at since before the First World War by the very same types of people who are in power and have been for, you know, at least a century.
Here's another comment from the Daily Mail article. It says a conventional, this is general speaking, Major General William Hicks. He says a conventional conflict in the near future will be extremely lethal and fast. The speed of events are likely to strain our human abilities. The speed at which machines can make decisions in the far future is likely to challenge our ability to cope, demanding a new relationship between man and machine. And what he's saying here is once this thing gets started, it's going to be like a ping pong ball in a room full of mousetraps. It's out of control. The control will be in the hands of the computers, essentially. And how do you stop the computers from overreacting?
Yes, I mean that's the billion-dollar question, and there are so many disturbing things about this. Not only the idea that warfare is going to be some sort of mechanized thing that gets beyond human control, but then there are so many further implications to this. We know from documents that have come out, for example, that the military, the purpose of deploying certain things in Iraq and other military engagements in the past, like the LRAD systems, was that they could then say that. Then use them as crowd control devices in military situations so that they could then bring them back home to the United States and say, well, now we're deploying them here, which is exactly what happened, for example, with the LRADs, these sonic devices that uh-huh. Work for crowd control and that were first deployed, you know, I believe, in the 2009 G20 Pittsburgh convention. The idea here is that anything that's deployed on the battlefield these days could and presumably will eventually be used for, policing on the domestic stage. And so the question is, who will these mechanized warriors ultimately be turned against? And even if they are in our control, in the sense that we can perfectly program them so they'll never go wrong somehow, but then the question is, who's our? I mean, it's the government, ultimately. And so anyone who is against the government, and to what extent does the government take that? What dissent is allowed and what dissent is not? And how do you combat a government that is armed with mechanized robot artificial intelligence killers that can, you know, defeat any army on the planet? That's where my mind goes with that type of thing, even beyond what's happening on the battlefield itself.
We've got about 45 seconds left. What do you think about Syria? Are we fighting over anything that Syria has, or is Syria merely a convenient laboratory to test the latest missiles and bombs?
There are a number of different factors, including a pipeline access and things like that. But I think part of it is a military laboratory. Part of it is also the laboratory for the testing of the R2P, the Responsibility to Protect Doctrine, the humanitarian love bombing. They have to keep that going. So there's a lot of things going on in Syria right now.
Well, we'll talk more when we get back. Well, James has published an article, What You're Not Being Told About the Afghanistan War. And when we get back, very interesting article, a lot of interesting historical insights. We'll be talking to James about what we aren't being told about the Afghanistan War. I'm Alfred Addis. This is Financial Survival. Be back in a moment. Please stay tuned.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold. gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com, or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey Water Filtration Systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231, and the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey Light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I'm Alfred Addison. This is Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver. Our guest is James Corbett, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, from thecorbettreport.com, an astute observer of geopolitical, political, economic events on around the world. He's published an article just lately called What You're Not Being Told About the Afghanistan War. And he points out that this October 7th, this year, 2016, marks the 15th anniversary of the invasion and occupation of Afghanistan. 15 years since the bombs began raining down, 15 years of drone strikes and civilian massacres, detainees, prison torture, insurgency, bombers, or bombings, drug lords, CIA kickbacks, 15 years of death, 15 years of destruction, and still the decades-long nightmare continues. Why are we still in Afghanistan? Is the American military, like the former Soviet Union, simply too weak to defeat the Afghans? Or is there an ulterior motive for the 2001 invasion that drives U.S. military to seek conquest and permanent occupation rather than military victory?
It's a good question, and you frame it in the right way, because generally in a military engagement or kinetic military activity or whatever you want to call it, generally there is some sort of military strategic objective in defeating an enemy, somehow defeating the bad guy on the battlefield. What battlefield? Which bad guy? What exactly is the purpose of this occupation? At any rate, the American public were told at the beginning that this was about 9/11 and it's going in to get Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. Osama bin Laden is dead. Al-Qaeda doesn't exist in Afghanistan. There are no training camps there anymore. So what exactly is the purpose of this occupation? And it's one of those stories where when you peel back the layers, it was never explicitly about 9/11. In fact, that's even mainline admitted history, although no one talks about it. But Donald Rumsfeld himself admitted in the September 11th commission hearings that the first national security directive of the Bush administration from the time he came into office formulated in a document that was circulated in June of 2001 was to go after the Taliban in Afghanistan militarily.
And just to frame that time properly, we're talking June 2001,
four months before 9/11, yes.
Yeah, before 9/11, we were already getting ready to go, back in our bags.
Exactly. Yeah. And of course, that makes perfect sense, because as Michelle Chostadovsky points out in that video and article that I posted up, the idea that they could have staged the military the theater war that they staged in October 2001, if it had only occurred to them to begin planning it after 9/11 is completely ridiculous. Any military strategic planner would tell you that what happened in October there was not something they whipped up in a few weeks. That was something that required months of logistics and operational planning, and that they definitely had in their back pocket. And again, that is open, mainline admitted history. You can read the White House's characterization of this NSPD, National Security Presidential Directive 9, which was the first major substantial national security decision directive of the Bush administration. As I say, it was formulated in June of 2001. It was on the president's desk waiting to be signed on September 4th, 2001, 1 week before 9/11, and it ultimately ended up getting signed in late October with just some extra preamble added to account for the events of 9/11. But it was there in substance before 9/11 ever happened. This was never about 9/11. So the only other question then, the obvious question is, what was it really about?
Well, the other question is just a little bit of a diversion, but what does this tell us about 9/11? Was it just good luck for the Bush administration that a bunch of Muslims knocked down a couple of buildings, or was 9/11 the attack, was that planned by the Bush administration?
Well,
in order to implement the war.
Exactly. Well, my answer is obviously with the latter.
Of course.
But even people who are not so skeptical of what the government's role in 9/11 was should know from the Iraq war, obviously, but also from the Afghanistan war, that the lies that they used to sell the public into war were that. They were lies. They were excuses for the government to implement objectives that it already had, including, of course, the passage of the Patriot Act, but that's another story entirely. But that's another example of it. The Iraq war, the Afghanistan war, the Patriot Act, all of that was already there waiting to happen, and 9/11 was the perfect excuse for all of that.
You list a number of, you should say there's multiple strategic objectives to be achieved in any war, but the plan to invade Afghanistan was not really about 9/11. You mentioned Caspian Sea oil and gas reserves, trillions of dollars of untapped mineral wealth in Afghanistan, the world's lucrative multi-billion dollar heroin trade sources almost entirely from Afghanistan. 90% of the world's opium is coming from Afghanistan. How is it possible that 90% of the world's opium is flowing from Afghanistan when we've got it locked down by the American military?
An excellent question, isn't it? It's not just the poppy production, which under the Taliban, whatever else you might say about them, they really did eliminate the poppy crop, more or less. It was down to historical lows.
Mm-hmm.
From the time of the NATO invasion onward, it has reached record level after record level, year after year after year. And that is no accident. In fact, of course, the U.S. did come out and admit over a decade ago now that, yes, the U.S. troops were guarding the poppy crops. But that's because, well, we can't let these poppy farmers, you know, wilt away, because then they'd turn to the Al-Qaeda side. They'd be on the side of the terrorists if they lost their income. So we have to help them grow and sell their poppies. And, you know, somehow or other, magically, this locked down, invaded, occupied country somehow or other has porous enough borders that all of this, you know, illegal opium gets out to be formed into heroin for the illegal drug trade. You know, it's they just can't figure out how to lock it down. Of course, for people who want the real story on that, there was a air base in Kyrgyzstan, which has been pointed to for some time as the staging point for NATO operations to fly heroin or opium anyway out of the country and onto the illegal drug market. But that Kyrgyzstan base was shut down a few years ago and turned over to the Russians. So I'm sure they're using other bases at this point. But it's been out there for quite a while that NATO is involved in the drug running itself, not just the protecting of the crops.
Where the article gets interesting from my perspective, it's been interesting all along, but where it becomes fascinating is you're explaining the history of the fascination with Afghanistan and based on its location, and you trace it back to 1904. Sir Halford John Mackinder, the director of the London School of Economics, and he published an essay in the Geographical Journal titled "The Geographical Pivot of History." He lays out the heartland theory. And this is a theory that has come to dominate political and geostrategic thought. And I'd like you to explain the Heartland Theory and also explain whether or not was John Mackinder, was this guy out of his mind? I mean, he's come up with a theory over a century ago that is still moving geopolitics today. Was he that much of a genius, or is this just a kind of insanity?
I think there is something to this. I don't think this is just completely insane ramblings. I think there is something to this in terms of geostrategy. So I think it's difficult to do this without people being able to see a map. But if you do look at a map of the Earth, or if you look at the Buckminster Fuller version of the map of the Earth, which lays it out more plainly, it's a version that presents the map in a way that looks strange to us, but is more technically accurate, and it shows kind of the almost a contiguous landmass. The landmass of the Earth is almost contiguous in when you lay it out that way. And what you have is fundamentally you have the Eurasian landmass. Everything from Europe all the way over to Asia is one giant landmass, which in Mackinder's theory is the world island. And so you have the sort of outlying islands of North America and Australia and those types of things. But the central part of the Earth in this formulation is the world island, which is everything from Europe all the way over to Asia. And the central part of that, the kind of crossroads of civilizations, which has been a crossroads for millennia, is the heartland, which encompasses the Caucasus, the Balkans, and that part of South Asia, including Afghanistan, that lies in the heart of the heartland, as it were, which goes some way, at any rate, to explaining why Afghanistan has been important historically. You can go back to the 19th century, where Afghanistan was the big chess piece the square of the chessboard that Russia and the British Empire were struggling over. They were involved in this decades-long, nearly century-long struggle, which was called the Great Game, and it was about all this diplomatic subterfuge they were doing and spies and counter-spies and those types of operations to try to maintain. The British Empire wanted to maintain control of Afghanistan and keep the Russians out, and it was an integrally important thing for them. But why? It is because of the location of Afghanistan, the fact that it does represent an important place that's a crossroads for the Caucasus, for Central Asia, for East Asia, for going over to Europe. It has been important. Now, that importance is lessened in the age of air travel and sea transport and things, but it still does have some teeth to it, and that was reinforced in the 1990s by none other than, of course, Zbigniew Brzezinski, the former National Security Advisor, who wrote a book that is now infamous in some circles anyways, The Grand Chessboard, where he predicted the first major war of the 21st century would take place right in this heartland area, and he was talking about something he described as the Eurasian Balkans, but it includes the Afghanistan is kind of the integral part of that. And lo and behold, 4 years after he wrote that book, the U.S. is embroiled in the first major war of the 21st century in that exact part of the world that he was identifying.
Well, again, what are we looking for that has taken 15 years? World War II, 4 or 5 years. I mean, we fought the Nazis and defeated the Nazis in 4 or 5 years. It was a pretty serious war, and yet we can't seem to handle the Afghans in 15 years. Or do we handle the Afghans? And if so, why are we still there? I know your article, you talk about empire and so on, but why don't you illuminate that?
Yes. Again, this comes back to the idea, is there some sort of military objective that's trying to be reached? Is there an enemy that will be eliminated? And I hope it's apparent by now that the war on terror is simply an excuse for military presence in any given area that is deemed to be a terrorist haven, so that it doesn't really matter. I mean, there is no point in the future where you're going to eliminate quote-unquote terrorism, which of course just means opposition, I guess, to military presence in an area. That's never going to happen. So it is the carte blanche to stay there forever. And that, we have to understand at this point, that is the point. The point is to have the US/NATO military presence in Afghanistan, to have military bases there and a military operation and military capability as as an incredibly important toehold in an incredibly important region that, of course, is right on the doorstep of Iran as well, which is another important part of this. It is not about Afghanistan so much as it is about being physically located in that area.
And we're also, in your article, you also reference the use of Afghanistan as a location to counter China and Russia in the new great game of the 21st century. So China and Russia are implicated in this also. But again, we hear the new great game. And we had the grand chessboard. And they referred to the great game in the 19th century. Is it only a game?
Yeah.
How many people are dying for a game, or is this really serious? Do we really need, does it really matter? Are we in danger if we don't control Afghanistan?
Well, define we.
Well, I'm speaking from the perspective of the United States, but from Japan's perspective, what difference does it make to Japan?
Well,
who controls Afghanistan?
Right. I mean, the average person in Texas or the average person in Tokyo, it does not make any difference whatsoever. It makes a difference from business points of view. Obviously, there are business interests in Afghanistan. There are energy security types of concepts that you could make some sort of case for. Well, we need Afghanistan if we want to have, you know, access to the Caspian oil and gas reserves and be able to pump them out reliably and all of that kind of talk, which I guess you could make the argument, well, you know, obviously we're energy import dependent, so that's important for the average person, but that's still a level of abstraction. But ultimately, again, those are considerations in what's going on, as is the drug trade. But ultimately, I think this is about the new great game is about the new Silk Road, I think. People might remember that China has, in the last few years, launched this idea of the new Silk Road, i.e. the Silk Road was the old trading route that China used to reach the rest of the world back 1,000, 2,000 years ago. Well, they're reviving that now, and that's going to be this corridor in Central Asia, South Asia, that goes through over to Europe, that connects China with Europe. And that's going to be, in their idea, that's going to be the sort of trading nexus of the 21st century, and it's going to revolutionize everything. So that's where it's heading, and it's the new great game to counter the new Silk Road and to try to maintain American/British, you know, Atlanticist hegemony.
It seems that the lesson here is those who don't learn from history are going to repeat it. We're going to have the Silk Road again. We're going to go through the same things we did 1,000 years ago and 2,000 years ago. It's kind of discouraging. Do people ever wise up? We're out of time, James, but quickly, do people ever wise up?
That's why we're here, and that's why we're...
Now, we're operating on the assumption that people do wise up. That is our objective. I want to thank all of you for listening. I want to thank you for being on the program. James, look forward to talking to you in a couple of weeks. I'm Alfred Addis. This is Financial Survival. Be back tomorrow with Melody Cedarstrom. In the meantime, the good Lord bless you, me, Melody, Tom, Todd, the producer, and James Corbett. Good night.
That's too bad. In my dreams, I have a plan. If I got me a